Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, we discuss the rich heritage and contemporary resonance of Islamic art and architecture. The panel includes Dr. Silk Ackerman, Director of the History of Science Museum at the University of Oxford, and Dr. Abdul Rahman Azam and Muhannad Shono, two of the creators of the forthcoming Islamic Arts Biennale in Jeddah, which is the first exhibition of its kind and offers a forum for the display and discussion of Islamic arts and cultures from around the world. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival in partnership with the Diriyah Biennale Foundation, hear insight into the beauty and breadth of the arts of Islamic cultures and the lasting significance they have had on our shared present.
Everyone, thank you all for joining. Today's session, before I go into introductions, just in terms of a bit of a prelude, we'll be discussing Islamic art. And today is an opportunity with this esteemed panel to discuss exactly what Islamic art is, why it's significant, but in particular, we wanted to discuss Islamic art through the lens of the Islamic Arts Biennale. And before I introduce the Biennale, I would just out of curiosity ask the audience here, who here has heard of the Islamic Arts Biennale before today? Just by a raise of hands. Okay, interesting. So just as a very quick introduction to what the Islamic Arts Biennale is, it's organized by the Diriyah Biennale Foundation. This is a dedicated foundation established by the Ministry of Culture in Saudi Arabia. And it takes place every 2 years. In 2023 was the inaugural edition. It was the first ever Islamic Arts Biennale. And remarkably, 600,000 people attended. It far exceeded any expectations in terms of the number of visitors. As you can see from the image, it's held within the Aga Khan award-winning Hajj terminal. So this is the Hajj terminal at Jeddah Airport. Now, of course, the terminal is still active. This is just a small section of the terminal dedicated towards the Biennale. Although I say small, it's actually 110,000 square feet. So it's still incredibly huge, despite it only being small in the context of the entire terminal. And the Biennale offers an opportunity for Islamic art to represent the global and cultural diversity of the Muslim world. So we will dive into this in far more detail, but at first I'd like to introduce the esteemed panel that we have with us today. To my immediate left, Dr. Abdulrahman Azam is one of the artistic directors of this year's Biennale. He is an acclaimed historian and author with publications including Saladin, The Triumph of Sunni Revival, The Other Exile, The Return of Sebastian, and between 2007 and 2017, he worked as Director of Communications and Cultural Advisor to Her Highness Sheikha Moza, Chairperson of the Qatar Foundation. In 2010, he led the partnership between the Qatar Foundation and the British Library, which has to date seen nearly 3 million documents digitized. He was a member of the Joint Advisory Board of Northwestern University, as well as the Qatar National Library. He previously worked as the Managing Director of the Islamic Text Society, as well as the founder of Hudhud Books. For the first Islamic Arts Biennale, Dr. Abdulrahman was a senior expert advisor on Al-Madar, and we'll discuss what exactly Al-Madar is shortly, and has been appointed as one of the artistic directors for the forthcoming edition. To the immediate left of Abdulrahman is Dr. Silke Ackerman. Dr. Silke Ackerman is Director of the History of Science Museum at Oxford University, an international center for research, teaching, and public engagement. Prior to her role at Oxford, she worked for 16 years in a curatorial and managerial roles at the British Museum in London. Dr. Ackerman's main research interests include the transfer of knowledge between cultures and generations. She leads on the museum's mission to explore the connections between people, science, art, and belief. The History of Science Museum generously loaned objects for the first Islamic Arts Biennale, and Seiko is a frequent contributor and also gave a very popular session, an engaging discussion on the significance and the functionality of astrolabes. And to the far left, to my far left, you have Muhannad Shono, who's the contemporary art curator for this year's, or the forthcoming Biennale. He's a multidisciplinary artist trained in architecture and working across a range of different mediums, across intimate works on paper, site-specific interventions, sculptural work, and robotic installations. He has established himself as one of Saudi Arabia's most original artistic voices. The main drivers for his practice draw on mythology, the usage of the line, the void, and natural and reclaimed materials to create speculative and generative narratives. He represented Saudi Arabia at the 59th International Art Exhibition, La Biennale de Venezia, with his project, The Teaching Tree. Mohanad's work was represented at the first Islamic Arts Biennale, and as I mentioned, he returns this year as the contemporary art curator, overseeing all of the contemporary works at the Biennale. So this is a short introduction to our esteemed panel. The introduction could have been much longer, the incredible achievements. But just before we begin, one important point is that we want to hear your voices and your opinions and your questions. So we'll keep the session, the discussion, till about 40 minutes. And my colleagues here, please shout at me if it goes beyond so that we leave enough time for questions at the end. So in terms of the context of the Islamic Arts Biennale, it's important at first to understand what we mean by Islamic art. The word Islamic art has been discussed and deliberated over for many, many years. And prior to the Islamic Arts Biennale, there were very few examples of large-scale exhibitions of Islamic art. And we're not talking about in the context of a museum or permanent or temporary exhibitions, we're talking about something which is quite grand in scale. Prior to this, perhaps the most recent, I say recent, it was almost half a century ago, was the 1976 World of Islam Festival in London. It was anchored at the Hayward Gallery, but it was distributed across institutions all over London. And it was really a kind of celebration of Islamic art, but also deliberately put on in the context of a lot of discussions around Islam at the time. Prior to that, perhaps the 1931 exhibition of Persian art at the Royal Academy could be a reference point, although exclusively featured Persian art, so not quite at the same scale. And prior to that, there is also the 1910 Munich exhibition, which was a very ambitious exhibition. It was entitled Masterpieces of Mohammedan Art. Over 3,000 artworks were displayed, with many institutions around the world contributing. It was considered the cultural event of the year. But crucially, all of these past examples were held or hosted in Europe. They were largely curated by Europeans or subjected to a particular worldview on Islamic culture. Where the Islamic Arts Biennale differs in Jeddah, it remains the only large-scale exhibition of Islamic art hosted within the heartland of the Muslim world in Saudi Arabia, which brought together both historic and contemporary artworks, uniting collections and commissions from both Muslim-majority and non-Muslim countries. The primary theme of the exhibition in its inaugural form was celebrating the art of Islam and the art of being a Muslim. So with that prelude, I think we can now dive into the primary question which I was referring to previously, which is understanding and defining this concept of Islamic art. I know it's a challenge, but I think it's important to tackle at the offset. Why does Islamic art matter? How are we defining Islamic art? And how does it play in our understanding of Islamic culture in its global impact? If I could start, Dr. Abdurrahman.
Well, it's not an easy question to answer. First of all, thank you so much. And as Rizwan mentioned, I'm very honored to have been appointed one of the artistic directors. There are three artistic directors, Dr. Julian Raby, Amin Jaffer, myself, and Mohanad, of course, who's attending the contemporary. And of course, it would be greatly amiss for me to say that today we're very lucky because we have with us one of our advisory committee, Venetia Porter, who's been very wonderful in helping advise us. To answer your question briefly is to say that my background is a historian. So when I was asked to be the artistic director, one of the artists, I was, you know, quite surprised because I've never curated anything in my life. But then the argument was that they wanted people to examine precisely this question. What is it, Islamic art? What is Islamic culture? How do we define it? To an attempt a brief explanation, and then we can perhaps delve into it in more depth, I would say that it's a manifestation, it's a celebration of Islamic culture. And the word Islamic here to me can be interpreted in two different ways. Islamic in the sense of that it is part of a sacred and divine manifestation, a transcendence. So anything to do with that is really the individual's attempt to understand the divine, to partake of the divine. And that is why many of the objects that actually will be at the Biennale and, you know, Islamic art objects are embodied with a lot of blessing as well, because they are part of the ritual. So if we look at an amazing prayer rug or rosary bead, these have been over the centuries been actually practiced. So there is a wonderful dynamic that takes place between a piece of art which is labeled Islamic because it has that spiritual dimension. On the other hand, and something else we can explore, when I think of Islamic, of course, we talk about the diversity of Islam. So here, you know, there is a kind of assumption that Islamic art is the art that comes out of the Arab world. Far from it. We all know that the Islamic world is incredible in its diversity. So are we talking about the manifestations of, you know, culture and art as in West Africa or in the Far East? How indigenous is it? What was the interpretation? Things that we have become accustomed to assuming are Islamic art may not appear as Islamic art, but that does not mean that they're not Islamic art, because they are driven by the same principles, but the manifestation may look different. So diversity of Islam is a critically important question that I'm sure we'll be talking about, and how far this diversity is actually held together by a sacred unity of principle.
Absolutely, and I think that's really important. You mentioned that that diversity aspect is not perhaps categorized as purely Arab culture or Arabic in particular. It's synonymous, of course, with Islam. And the Biennale tried to represent that, of course, works from China to Spain and everywhere in between. But we'll come on to specific examples shortly. So, okay, if I can pass the question over to you. I know you've grappled with this question, both in terms of Islamic science, Islamic art. I'd love your perspective on this and how you're defining it in this context.
Well, thank you. And it's, of course, very difficult to follow such a brilliant answer from you, Abdulrahman. For me, art in general is humans' response to creation, to the beauty out there, to the challenges we face, to making sense of what's around us, to making sense of who we are and where we are and what we are doing. So it is a lot more than, forgive me, pretty objects, which is one of the driver behind many of the previous exhibitions, that they are wonderfully beautiful objects to look at. They are like something you admire from the outside, but there was no opportunity to engage deeply with the drivers behind creating this artwork. So I would also advocate to use the word art far more widely in the terms of skilled, a skilled response to something. So I would never divide between or distinguish between art and science, because that is a very modern and very recent introduction. In the past, it was all part of the same thing. The word science is a very modern word. But also what is so beautiful about the Islamic Art Biennale is that it literally reintroduces Islam back into Islamic art. Faith, the driver, belief. What is it about? What is so special here, which is different from just a beautiful piece in a showcase?
Thank you, Silke. And we'll come back to this question on the links with Islam, art and science rather, shortly, because I'm keen to get your thoughts on this. Mohana, turning to you, and I think one of the key things with the Biennale was this, the ability for this conversation to happen between both historic objects and contemporary artworks that were commissioned or loaned for the Biennale. I'd love your perspective on thinking of Islamic art in the current day, how it's interpreted, defined in the kind of realm of spirituality, and particularly with it perhaps in the context of Saudi Arabia as an artist yourself.
The uniqueness of this Biennale that's bringing together historical objects of the past with contemporary concerns, you know, the question of what is Islamic art, I think the selection of the contemporary artists is going to show that it's not going to be your classical, traditional approach to what we think Islamic art is, whatever that means. But in terms of approaching artists to respond to the theme of the Biennale, we're looking for artists that might have had a personal lived history with Islam, or they come with a spiritual depth that echoes some of the philosophies, narratives, and threads that exist within Islamic belief systems. What we're looking for here also is to expand the dialogue, because an artist that is not Muslim will do and conduct research and develop understanding about Islam that they will bring together in their investigations and ideas, thus enhancing this idea of dialogue and exchange between cultures and really embracing this very wide geographical presence of Islam currently around the world.
That's fascinating. I think we can, with that, move on to the second question, which touches on this point, Mohana. Maybe if I come back to you first, and in reflecting on the first Islamic Arts Biennale, you all contributed in various ways. Silke, you were, of course, invited to join at your institution. But I'd like to explore the role of Islamic art, particularly with Saudi Arabia playing host to the first inaugural Islamic Arts Biennale, in terms of demonstrating its contributions to both culture and civilization of the world. The, of course, topic of our discussion here today is Islamic enlightenment through the realm of Islamic art. But I'd love your thoughts on what role Islamic art can play in supporting that our understanding of Islamic culture and its representation to the world.
I mean, currently in Saudi Arabia, Saudi is going through a word we're hearing a lot, which is change. And this word is used quite extensively, but what does it really mean? The Islamic Arts Biennale is actually a fantastic manifestation of how bringing together historical objects, notions of the past, and notions of Islam in dialogue, in physical proximity, with contemporary investigations. The role of contemporary practice is to question, is to imagine, is to think in different ways. To allow this in proximity with such ideas of established ideas of Islam is a huge indication of the kind of diverse change and dialogue that is underway in Saudi Arabia.
Could you share perhaps some examples of the artworks? Of course, your own was exhibited at the first Biennale, but I think it'd be nice to maybe explore any particular examples that perhaps resonate very strongly with what you were just discussing as a kind of case study to reflect. And a lot of the people here mentioned they weren't familiar with the Biennale in its first edition. Are there any examples that come to mind of the artworks that were on display?
I think at the first Biennale, it was a moment to test the waters. How do we bring these things together? Is it going to be acceptable? I wouldn't say that there wasn't a sense of nervousness at the opening, but I think the resilience of the public and the seriousness of the discourse and their appetite for something new in terms of how we approach these ideas was seen across all the historical objects and how the audience interacted with them, as well as the contemporary commissions that tackled all kinds of traditional ideas and rituals of Islam, but took them into a new contemporary space.
Fascinating. Thank you, Mohamed. So, okay, if I could turn to you, and perhaps it'd be great to understand from your perspective how you were approached as an institution, as the director of an institution, and specifically what your reflections were of the first Biennale as someone from the other perspective who was invited to contribute, and how you felt it was helping as part of this discourse widely up.
It was one of the most life-changing, exhilarating experiences I've ever had. And one of the reasons for that is the phenomenal openness to try something really new. You spoke about change, Marlon. The change and the taking of ownership, I would add to that. It is not somebody else in a European or American museum that talks about Islamic art. It's taking ownership, and it's bringing this together with a public that was fun. It's just mind-boggling. I was standing there seeing locals engage with the collections in a way that you would never see in a European American museum or in many of the places that have brought in museums into specific areas. There is such an openness and interest, people coming back as families again and again. And that enabled us, the museum I represent here, to have a very different engagement with audiences and new questions that were asked. It's not the same patterns of questions what you get in so many other exhibitions that may, on the outside, have a similar topic. This was completely a game changer. And that was so exciting for us.
And we've got on display, or the image now is, of course, the beautiful astrolabe from Shah Abbas that was on display at the first Biennale. This was actually the first object that visitors encountered. And again, this set the tone in terms of how this was not a traditional exhibition or traditional either art exhibition or historic exhibition in the representation of both objects and artworks. And here we've got this kind of deconstructed version of the astrolabe. Could you perhaps talk a bit about your sense of pride, I guess, at this being the first object and what it represents?
It was absolutely phenomenal. And for those of you in the audience who look at it, this is not a mirror ring. This is an astrolabe, the most sophisticated astronomical instrument ever invented before the invention of the computer as we know it, taken apart, exploded, each in its own case. And the size was such that you could weave around it. behind that was the call, I mean, the soundscape was the call to prayer, because that was the section it was in. This instrument can, amongst other things, be used to determine prayer time. And I have never, ever seen audiences engage with, we have quite a few of those we look after in our collections. I've never seen audiences engage with an object like that, as it was here, because there was the boldness to do something very, very different. When I talked to colleagues back in Oxford about this, I said, you want to do what? Yep. So bringing it back also into a spiritual context. You mentioned that our museum is the Museum of the History of Science. You know, science puts people off. It's something you were bad at school and you feel embarrassed about, and my God, can we put the threshold even higher? So is this science, I ask you, or is this art? Or is this belief, because it enables you to do your duty as a Muslim? And I would advocate it is all of this. It is all of this. And that is where the point of contributing to world culture is always something which rubs me up slightly the wrong way. This isn't contributing to world culture. This is world culture. Okay? Every single person in this room is world culture. Everything you do, every artwork you create, everything you do with your children becomes automatically part of world culture. And I think the Islamic Art Biennale has this phenomenal opportunity to get away from, you know, there's a group of people, they're not us, it's Islam, they're contributing to something. Enigmatically, world culture, whatever it is and whoever owns it. No, it is it. And I think that is so phenomenal about it.
Absolutely. It was also the first object we installed, so fond memories of that first milestone in place, which is fantastic. Abdulrahman, coming to you, and I'd love to hear specifically, you talked about Al-Madar, probably not too familiar with everyone in the room, but it's something incredibly important to the Biennale in terms of reflecting that global attitude towards Islamic culture.
Madar is part of the Biennale. It's the institutional participation. This is where we invite Islamic cultural institutions from across the world to join us. Just want to go back to the point that Mohammed raised and Silke. The most striking thing, what the Biennale is not about, it is not about Saudi Arabia propagating its view of Islam. If it were, I wouldn't have touched it. And what Mohammed is saying is remarkably perceptive and intelligent. Yes, there is change in Saudi, but we're not falling into the trap of using terms such as Saudi becoming more liberal or more modern, all that. These are just tropes and words. The change is profound. It's on a very, very profound level on every single level, societal, economic, intellectual, political, ideological. There's a deep well that Saudi Arabia is drawing from and which is now enriching the world. So that's the first point. The second point, when we were asked to invite institutions from across the Muslim world, literally from West Africa all the way to Indonesia, we've got participation coming from across the Muslim world and some amazing institutions, including, of course, Silke's from Europe and elsewhere. It was driven by two principles. The first one was that Islam is not a one-way street. Islam did not just come out of the Arab world and we as Arabs somehow enriched the rest of the world. And unfortunately, many Arabs tend to fall into that trap of, you know, it's an Arab religion. Islam was enriched by the edges, if one can call them such. When Islam reached the Far East, when it reached Africa, it was deeply enriched through piety, through sacrifice, through knowledge, through dedication. There are many historical anecdotes of people from Timbuktu, which everyone hears about as a kind of fairy tale library. Timbuktu is a great place of scholarship. There are many scholars from Timbuktu who went to Morocco and Egypt and came back and said, we can learn, there's nothing there to learn. We have it. Islam, so this relationship between the edge and the center is one which is at the heart of Al-Madar. That this is a two-way dialogue. Islam comes out from the center, yes. We can recognize the place of Mecca and Medina. We cannot but do that since it's, of course, the Biennale is in Jeddah. But we are also humbled by the fact that Muslims have actually enriched it through their knowledge and through their piety. At the same time, Madar's core at Madar, we are insisting and we work very hard with the institutions, curatorially, artistically, intellectually, to make sure that they tell their story. So when we have institutions coming from the Far East, and we have institutions coming from across the Muslim world, initially, and we did that, we had a workshop in February a few months ago, and initially there's a bit of hesitation because they come to Saudi and they're all feeling, oh, we should be saying and showing things that people in Saudi Arabia would recognize as Islamic. And we're saying, no, we want to know what you feel is, tell us your story. How did Islam integrate with you? What were the indigenous traditions that existed pre-Islam? How did they become ingrained within Islam? How did it help enrich Islam? And the dynamic that each one of us is coming up with is incredible. How do you interpret your version of Islam? And it's incredible to see how the diversity and the orthodoxy gel into the most creative, beautiful, profound way. If I can add just one further point, which I think is important, the other challenge we set for our Madar institutions is to challenge what we call the narrative of decline. And unfortunately, Islamic culture, in the way it's presented, is always seen as somehow we had a great civilization. And of course, you know, the famous 1798 date. If you ever study Islamic history, the modern Middle Eastern studies start in 1798 when Napoleon went to Egypt. And here's the word enlightenment, and the talk is about enlightenment. And this is, of course, preconceived on the idea that somehow the European enlightenment starts then. And since European enlightenment is based on a great respect for the kind of Greek and civilization, there's like a leap from Greek civilization to European enlightenment. And the Islamic period was somehow had its moments, but from about the 16th, 17th century began to decline. Total nonsense. I'm not going to go too much, but Abdurrahman al-Jabarti, one of the great historians who recorded Napoleon's entry into Egypt, his father, Hassan al-Jabarti, used to go up on the roof of the house to observe the stars and have discussions about planetary movements. We have records upon records of great scientific creativity taking place in the 17th, 18th century, which predates the European intervention in the region. So we give our institutions their voice, we encourage them to tell their stories, and we tell them, forget this narrative of decline, be proud. Islamic culture is not a was and is an is. It is a living tradition.
Absolutely. And I think one of the great successes of the first Biennale was Al Madar, where it gave the opportunity for, as you mentioned, all these voices to come together. There were dozens of institutions that lent objects. You mentioned Timbuktu, of course, manuscripts from Mali were on display. Again, one small example of the incredible diversity of institutions from Tunisia, from Spain, from all over the world that were contributing.
If I can just say about Timbuktu,
yeah,
about Mali, which makes it even more interesting, was that we respect the literary tradition of Mali. Of course, we have to. But we also had a video of what I call the, the Jriot or the Jeli, who were the, because we have to respect that in that part of the world, the oral tradition and the oral history was phenomenally important. So when people say to us, oh, West Africa doesn't have a great Islamic tradition, it's because the stories were not written down. They're passed through the singers, the Jeli singers. So we had a recording of that to see how memory is preserved. And this way we respect the local traditions and the format in which their culture is being passed on.
Absolutely.
Rizwan, may I
please
interject? Can I just ask the audience, does everybody know what Al Madar means?
Oh, sorry.
So it means,
the Arabs in
orbit.
The orbit.
I think that's probably helpful to explain that.
The orbit, the kind of constellate, this the center point for all of these institutions.
Absolutely, orbit, with the center, of course, the edges. Yeah.
Thank you, Silke, for that reminder. That's a very important point. I will then come back to you now that you volunteered yourself to and zoom out a little bit from the Biennale, just exploring your all of your backgrounds in this conversation. And I want to come back to this dialogue you were mentioning between exploring the science and the role of Islamic civilizations, particularly in the advancement and transfer of scientific knowledge. You touched on the astrolabe as a beautiful example of that. But can you expand on this slightly just to, because as Abdurrahman was just mentioning, there is this assumption, perhaps in some circles, that the transfer of knowledge went from the classical period and then straight into the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, and there's this period in between that was slightly detached or may have had some peripheral contribution. What's your take on this as someone, of course, who's working as a director of the History of Science Museum, in terms of this transfer of knowledge and the contribution of Islamic civilizations in this context?
Well, to quote Abdulrahman, that is complete nonsense. When I studied, there was the feeling that classical texts, or this is still being taught actually, classical texts were translated into Arabic as a kind of preserving them. And then they were passed on to the European Renaissance, untouched, nothing done with them, and that enabled the European Renaissance. That is complete nonsense. Because These texts were translated, yes, but they were enriched, they were studied, observations were added because the classical text had no observations. It's almost completely theoretical. The other knowledge was brought into it. It was a transfer of knowledge, which then also passed on to others and carried on. It's a very, very dynamic movement. And that is one of the reasons why I'd like to get away from those labels. Our museum has a section called Islamic science. Now, what on earth is that? And why are we not talking about Christian science? I urge everybody in the room to Google Christian science. Do you know what you get? Scientology. Okay? So, why are we saying there is a thing such as Islamic science, but there isn't Christian science? The calendar we all use on a daily basis, the calendar which brought us here to whatever today is, the 29th of June, I believe, 2024, that was introduced by Pope Gregory in 1582 for one reason only, to get Easter right. If that's not religion and science in the service of religion, I don't know what is. So why are we saying there is such a thing that is different? I would much rather look at it from the what are the common questions that we're all facing and that are being answered in different ways, at different places, at different times, but they're the same questions. And I think that would be a much healthier way to look at this, rather than bringing into a corner. The other question, of course, is what is science? Now, the term science for most of the objects we have, the astrolabe we showed earlier, is actually not adequate. If I did a random show of hands here in the room and said, what do you think science is? Many people might say, well, you know, it's chemistry, physics. Yeah, I see some nods in the room. What about astrology? What about divination? What about trying to make sense of the world around us? So the word science comes from a term, a Latin term, scientia, which is knowledge. The Arabic word ilm is about knowledge. And that is far more important here, that we get back to what is actually meant here. And that brings us to this constant dynamic weaving of information. So what is in our museum, in some ways displayed as Islamic science, actually comes from India. That is not helpful. Hence my attempt to get away from that, and that was one of the reasons why it was so beautiful with the Islamic Art Biennale, that we could ask, what are those common questions?
Absolutely, and I think on that we've talked a lot about the diversity that has impacted the Muslim world on the peripheries, and you've mentioned different civilizations, but just coming behind it to you in terms of the unifying factor is this kind of shared heritage, the shared concept of spirituality that permeates, that brings Muslims together in a spiritual sense. And in the context specifically of contemporary art, both in the Biennale and your own work, looking, of course, at concepts such as migration and forced migration, what role does Islamic art today play in expressing this shared heritage? We've talked about so many disparate voices and different influences, but where is this concept of shared heritage in the contemporary world today? Is it still binding Islamic art together in whatever term it's being defined as?
Well, I think the shared heritage that we're experiencing in the Biennale is the fact that in terms of the contemporary commissions, not specifically approaching artists that are Muslim, though that is one component of it, but the dialogue that we can bring together by introducing and weaving these concepts of Islam, philosophies, narratives, even mythologies, and what we can discover about each other. You know, Jeddah is historically a port city. So what we're welcoming back to Jeddah right now is new congregations of ideas, new congregations and ways of seeing, collective ways of imagining, ways of reading, not singular kind of dictated ways of how we want to approach this narrative or that, but more acceptance and dialogue between different practices, whether it's historical or contemporary works. What's important is that the contemporary has its fingers on the pulse of the questions of today. And to draw a line from the historical objects through into our contemporary concerns, to show that curiosity of science still exists and is being manifested through contemporary global conversations, which is what we're trying to welcome back to Jeddah and to manifest in this Biennale.
Absolutely, and I think that's it. a key point in that the finger and the pulse in the context of Saudi Arabia, which is often not perceived to be a place where the contemporary concerns are being dealt with and so on. So I think that's an incredibly important point. And turning to you, Abdurrahman, you mentioned, of course, you're a historian. You've talked and looked into the lives of many historical figures. And I'd love to have your take as an historian looking at the world of Islamic art in particular. If we take one example, you've written extensively on Salahuddin or Saladin as a figure, as a preeminent figure in both the East and the West. So in historical narratives, both in the East and West, there have been very diverging narratives often, which have happened in terms of the example of someone like Saladin. How does Islamic art help us to understand the contributions of figures such as Saladin and others to broader culture, both in the historical context, but looking at it through the lens also of Islamic art?
It's a difficult one because for the simple reason that the more time you study and write history, the less you know, and the less you know about the personality. You think you start off with great intentions of writing a biography, and by the end of it, you really know so little about the person. Salahuddin especially, since he's such a mythical figure. I would say that, and this is a very subjective answer, that what strikes me about a period like Salahuddin's period, or the medieval history or Middle Ages, is that to the modern mind, which is largely a secular mind, we live in a secular age, and although many of us may be religious, we still live very much in a secular mindset. We cannot conceive of how deeply religious and how deeply traditional societies and life was there. That the idea of death, which was something which was very much at the, you know, preeminent in the minds of most people. People lived, of course, died much younger than us. The idea that from the moment you're born to the moment you die, everything in your life through society, education, whatever you did, was actually within a spiritual framework. And this applied as much to the Islamic world as, of course, to the Christian world, where religion was so deeply ingrained in your mindset. And that, of course, manifests itself in the culture. So Salahuddin himself, as we know, is a Kurd who ruled over a great Islamic empire, which had Turks and Arabs, and, you know, and of course he's famous for Jerusalem, as we all know that. But ultimately, I would say, to answer your question, is to see the manifestations of the incredible pieces of culture and art that actually emerge from this period as being part of the daily life of the Muslims, as opposed to something which was put aside to be admired. So the incredible swords and the military weapons that he had, of course, the household goods, the incredible Ayyubid madrasas which were built in Egypt and Syria, their beauty. And here it comes back to maybe a point Silke alluded to, which is that the functionality and the beauty are not separate. These were functional pieces. I don't think Salahuddin had things, but he would not have seen them as Islamic art. He'd have seen them part of his daily life, the armor he wore, everything he did, the manuscripts he looked at. But they were functional, but they were beauty. And the reason that functionality and beauty were so closely intertwined is because the society was so deeply religious. They did not see a separation. I think it's a secular concept that we probably separate the two. That's my sort of attempt at answering this question, but it's a complex one.
Absolutely. I've given a few complex questions. Maybe we turn back to the Biennale, and I think it'd be good to reflect as we move towards the next Biennale, which will be hosted in 2025. As I mentioned, over 500,000 people attended the first edition. This is an example of an image. This is an image from Gallery 3, I believe, where again you can see in the background these incredible, huge Timurid Qurans that were on display for the first time, I believe, from Medina. They were from the endowment libraries in Medina. A number of endowments which were sent over time historically by rulers were sent to this library. And again, the Biennale had the ability to display things from the Holy Lands, Mecca and Medina, that had never been displayed outside of the Holy Land in conversation with contemporary artworks. But I want to bring it back to the venue, and specifically we talked a bit about the Hajj terminal and the significance of Jeddah. Mohammed, you touched on this as being a port city and the historical legacy of that. If I could come back to you first on this. What is the significance of the Hajj terminal specifically as the venue of the Biennale in the context of all the discussions we've been having so far?
I think it really manifests what the spirit of the Biennale is: a place of congregation, of coming together of people of the world, but also, you know, what we experienced in the last edition or the first edition was that a lot of the people who visited were actually on their way for pilgrimage or umrah. And then they became part of this journey of introduction or reorientation, if you will, of this experience that they were undertaking. So the content, though it was not part of their intention, let's say, a niyyah, to attend a Islamic arts biennale, but it became part of the experience that helped shape this dialogue. So this canopy, which houses this place of meeting where people would come from around the world to this port city, becomes a living embodiment of its purpose, but reimagined.
And just looking at this image, I wonder if, Mohandas, you could touch briefly on the, when we look at the layout of the Biennale, the outdoor space was reserved for all of these contemporary artworks, often larger in scale. Could you talk a bit about how that was arranged, or the intention behind the ability for having these artworks out underneath the canopies?
So the Biennale has several purpose-built indoor spaces that host Gallery 1 and 2, which is the Bidaya, but also Al Madar in 3 and 4. And also we have a new component coming and several other indoor dedicated pavilions to historical objects in dialogue, in sequence with contemporary commissions. The outdoor space becomes its own kind of living entity or space. For the next edition, it will have its own theme that flows from the theme, the wider theme of the Biennale, which we can't talk about
yet. Reveal yet.
I'm not allowed to. You all signed NDAs, we can probably say it. So this outdoor space becomes its own manifestation, which we want to explore in a unique way. And we're very excited to reveal that.
Well, we can talk about Al-Musalla, which will be outside.
Yes.
Which has been released. So I don't know if you want to touch very briefly on that
For the next edition, much like the idea of certain pavilions, like the Serpentine Pavilion, for example, here, a prayer pavilion has been, you know, conducted as a prize, as a competition between different architects, responding to this idea of a contemporary musalla or prayer space that will be revealed in the next edition, but then exist beyond the edition and have its own permanent place somewhere in the city.
Excellent, thank you. Abdurrahman, touching on Al-Madar, rather the Hajj terminal, which actually featured as part of Al-Madar last time, if I'm not mistaken, there was a dedicated recognition of the Hajj terminal, both as an award-winning space. Could you touch a bit more about the history of the Hajj terminal? Because I think it's also a fascinating story. Hajj, of course, just passed. We're only a few weeks away. Millions of people have passed through this very terminal. So the story and the significance of this space has an added consequence to the context of the Biennale. But if you could touch on that also.
What made it so significant in the last edition of the Biennale was that it was the 40th anniversary of the Hajj terminal, which was built in 1982-83. Of course, it was a response by the Saudi government, the number of pilgrims increasing exponentially every year. How did they do it? And they appointed an American US architectural firm, SOM, who actually spent a long time trying to build it and trying to air condition the whole thing, which was completely unfeasible. And after a period of time, there was a Bangladeshi American architect, a man called Fazlur Khan, who came up with this idea of a canopy tent, which did not require air conditioning. We had these Teflon things which kept the cool air in. And I urge you all to go to it. It's something which is quite unique, because I think Mohammed would also admit the Saudis do not use it, because the Saudis don't go to the Hajj terminal. It's actually for the non-Saudis. And it's only used 1 month every year. So 11 months a year, it's not used. It's quite a unique thing to come to it. And I promise you, please come and see it. It is incredible, the space, how cool it is, how incredible it is. Now, Fazlur Khan worked extremely hard at this SOM. They won the Aga Khan Award of Architecture. And as it happened, he unfortunately passed away a few months in 1983, just after the building had been completed. He never actually saw his legacy. And yet every time I go, I always think of him, because this is a man who, through his sheer brilliance, built something for which millions upon millions of Muslims have benefited. So sometimes you do something and you don't see the benefit yourself, but you leave a legacy behind. So please try to come and see it. It's honestly, it's just something else. I really applaud whoever decided to make the Biennale at the Hajj terminal. It's an inspired location.
It really is. It really is unbelievable. I'm conscious of time. So, okay, we're going to come to you very quickly and then we'll wrap up, because I believe we have 15 minutes left and I want to leave time for questions. So,
as a museum person, what made it so different was that the moment you stepped into it, it was an immersive experience. It was not something where you went into a room and you went from A to B and then you went out again. You were part of a place that was part of probably one of the most important journeys that many people will ever undertake. And that so beautifully made the point with all the visitors, who many of them were on a journey, they were on pilgrimage or the Umrah, that culture is something we're constantly on a journey on to pick up wherever we go. It's not something where you go into a place and say, I'm doing culture today and I'm going to the museum and I feel so virtuous about it. It's all around us. And that is so beautifully epitomized by this
beautifully
place.
Put. And I think we had a number of historic images, also images from Rim al-Faisal of pilgrims going on their journey, absolutely. Many passing through Hajj Terminal, which was beautiful to see. I'm conscious of time. We don't have too much time left, but I do want to open the floor. We have many faces with us, and I'm sure many, many questions. So if I could please ask, yes, the gentleman at the back.
Thank you. At least from a secular perspective, one of the great functions of art is considered to be to speak truth to power and to challenge dominant narratives. So think of it in the context of Saudi Arabia and the other kind of, I guess, conceptions or maybe misconceptions that we might have about both Islamic art and Muslim artists. To what extent is there art within the Biennale that has that kind of challenging approach and narrative, and how does that get brought in?
Interesting question. We can't, of course, talk about the forthcoming Biennale, but perhaps reflecting on the past Biennale. Mohanad, of course, your work discusses many of these issues, particularly in relation to migration, but is there perhaps something that comes to mind from the previous Biennale in relation to the question about...
No, I think we can speak a little bit about what we're intending to do for the next Biennale, because I think that's important. Like I said, the first Biennale was testing the waters. Now, the intention here is to push, but not push anything over the edge. We want to explore more nuanced ideas, more diverse ways of seeing, like I said. That in itself is challenging. We want to a little bit exist in a very spiritual, peaceful, and sometimes a little bit uncomfortable space that we're exploring with these ideas. We want to be touching on and drawing from ideas of the heavenly, but it very much must be rooted in contemporary issues and challenges of the earth and what we're experiencing at the moment. We are not trying to clap for ourselves through the Biennale. We are trying to have a dialogue, and it's important to change stereotypes and misconceptions is to face them face on, head on, bravely, and hopefully talk about bigger and more important things.
Thank you, Mohanad. Any other points on the panel? Otherwise, if we have any more questions. Yes, I think there are a few. Yes, please. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. This was such an incredible conversation. I come from the film industry, and I don't know how much you all work with film or television, but you know, we've been doing a lot in America and in Los Angeles specifically with Muslim artists that are exploring Islam and Muslim representation in film and television. An example would be Miss Marvel, but there's lots of other kind of projects like that. And there's kind of two themes that I would pull out just as, and to hear your thoughts on. The first is speaking more from a contemporary perspective, but much of the kind of contemporary art, like popular, when you talk about popular culture, is pretty anti-religion or pretty critical of religion, just generally speaking. And Islam, there is a very strong kind of perception of Islam being a source of violence, right? And so for folks who are operating within kind of contemporary popular art and culture, that is something that you're in conversation with, because in cultural kind of conversation, you're responding to something that already exists, right? And so that is one thing that a lot of Muslim artists are struggling with, is like, how do you kind of talk about Islam outside of that like violent kind of framework, but also staying, you know, in conversation with kind of what's happening in popular culture. And then the second piece is there is still a lot of, I think, fraught feeling around even the expression of religion by Muslim artists and like their own practice and their own relationship to faith. And so that is something I'd also just love to learn a little bit more. As somebody who, you know, finds a lot of solace in my faith, like I will say a lot of the contemporary artists that I've worked with have a very complicated relationship to their identity as a Muslim. And so how do you kind of explore that, and how art can be kind of a space for that as well?
Thank you very much. So if I could just briefly paraphrase, there are two aspects that you've discussed. One, of course, is the association with violence in Islam, and the second is expressing actually religious identity within Islam. Abdurrahman, perhaps if I could turn to you in terms of that, I guess more of a discussion point, less than maybe a question, of misrepresentations. I think it's more about mischaracterizations and also expressions of pride within artworks or within expressions of Islamic identity, and how we can navigate that in the context of the conversation.
I would just simply say that these struggles that the artists are going through, of course, are a product of the modern world and the way we live at the moment and the way Islam is portrayed. But I'd also say that throughout Islamic history, the same struggles have taken place. It's just that they were not articulated in a certain way. But I promise you, what we see as classic Islamic thinkers and writers, when you delve deep enough, they themselves struggled with the same issues. It's just that we're not setting the narrative. The narrative is being set somewhere else, and so we are somehow passive. So that an artist struggles with their identity, with their way they express their creativity, with their faith, without their faith, is something which is, I think, has been eternal in Islamic history. And what I find is so fascinating about the Biennale is that we are putting historical objects and contemporary objects together, and refusing to accept that there's a line between the two. And through that, and allowing the objects to speak, you do see a much more nuanced view of things, that in fact some of the things that you think are modern are actually not modern at all. They've been debated for centuries and so forth. I think that's probably the comment I'd make now.
I just want to build on that by saying, not starting these commissions and these conversations from a point of ceding the floor of the narrative, but not feeling like we need to justify our position and our perspective, and kind of feeling a bit of pride in our lens and our perspective and how we see things. And I think that's very much on the mind of every conversation I'm having with a contemporary artist, is to really think of things through our perspective and leading and not being passive.
If I can just quickly, we talk about modern artists and the fact that they may be struggling with their religion, but we don't know the people who did those astrolabes. They may have struggled with their religion. We simply don't know. So I think you need to look at it in a much more holistic sense. It actually doesn't matter what the artist believes in. What matters is the creativity and the beauty that actually comes out and the society that actually produces this beautiful culture. I think that's more interesting than whether the person, the individual, had an existential angst or not.
But I think this is where the Biennale,
we're setting different parameters. We're setting
absolutely parameters, yeah. Positioned within Saudi Arabia, has the ability to present it in a different way. I'm conscious of time. We've got time for one more question. I think the gentleman at the back had his hand up first.
I run an architectural practice in Manchester. So listening to where you described the terminal has an immersive experience for culture. Architecture is an immersive experience of culture. And for Muslims, and we see this in the Middle East now, is that the home is the most immersive cultural experience for everybody. It's where you walk into a Muslim home and it's the expression of their culture. Now, what we're seeing a trend with internationally, and especially in the Middle East, is homes are just flats. They're very just productive, technological, the home, the flat in London, Rio de Janeiro, Middle East. Is just the same box. That expression of culture and a home and essentially the divine experience that somebody shares of their faith expressed in their home is lost. And does the Biennale, that is one of the most pertinent things to explore. That's something that will be explored. How do we live in a culturally vibrant home that reminds of the divine, where previously you could go into a privacy, into the roof, you go to the roof, you see the stars, you're connected, you got top, bottom, separation, men, women, et cetera, prayer room, the direction of the toilets, all this kind of stuff was part of the cultural immersive experience of walking into a Muslim home. I think that's getting lost.
I think if I may just quickly respond to that, I think I disagree with you. I think there's some incredible developments taking place in the Arab world. I will speak, Mohammed knows, of course, what's happening in Dubai and all the changes that are taking place. I'd urge you to go to look at what's happening in Qatar and the project called the Mashaira Project, because it's not so much to do with the divine, although, of course, everything has to do with the divine. It's to do with the traditional quarters, the neighborhoods, the hara, of how people used to go walking distance. That, of course, you walk to the mosque, you have your neighbors, you have your shops and so forth. And the urban planning and the regeneration of cities in the Muslim world are beginning to respond. Now, of course, organically, when you go to a place like Cairo, it's almost impossible because it's, you know, layers upon layers. But I think you will find that in Saudi Arabia, I certainly know from my experience in Qatar, there is a real sincere attempt to re-engineer the urban planning, to make it more humane, to make it more friendly, to make it neighbor-friendly. So this goes beyond the Biennale, of course it doesn't. But I think this you raise an important point, and there are some positive responses to it. And I'm sure in Riyadh, I mean, you probably know more, the art areas were now being developed to be much more...
There is a much more focus on quality of life, on public space, and the Biennale is a fantastic example of that.
Perfect. Well, we now need to wrap up. I've received the official signal for wrapping up.
So
thank you very much. Thank you very much all for your time. I really appreciate all of your contributions. And finally, I'd like to thank the esteemed panel who have been contributing to this discussion today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.